For the week of November 25th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 171, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gill.
How has New York been? I mean, you keep reading about all this stuff with Sandy. Are you still being affected by the hurricane from early November?
Well, the city certainly is, absolutely. It'll be years before people recover. I mean, it's a natural disaster. You know, it's not a natural inconvenience. So it's going to take a long time for people to get their lives back together. Most people have power back. Most people have their lives back. I certainly was very minimally affected, but transportation into and out of the city still has little wrinkles to it that you have to pay attention to. And more importantly, the areas that were really hard hit in Staten Island and Jersey, you know, people's lives have been upended forever. You know, their homes have been destroyed. Neighborhoods are destroyed. There's still not power in a few neighborhoods and areas. And, you know, rebuilding those lives and homes will take many, many years.
A Natural Inconvenience. Is that the sequel to Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth?
Well, certainly, you know, it has raised the stakes on global warming. It'd be interesting to see what happens. But certainly the governor of New York, the governor of New Jersey, a lot of politicians in the area, you know, you wake up to these things when they affect you personally. So you've seen the effects in a lot of other parts of the country, the terrible droughts that we've had, the other things. But now that we've had the storm hits you, you say, oh, my gosh, we got to do something about this. So we'll see.
Well, it certainly didn't keep people away from the movie theater, at least, all over the country here in the U.S., and it looks like the world.
Oh, well, people were, you know, happy to go to a movie and escape for a few hours from any problems that they had, that's for sure.
Well, we'll definitely be talking a little bit about that this week. In fact, we have a lot of news to catch up on since we were off last week, and we're going to do it all alone without any guests, so hopefully we can have an episode that is under the running time of the latest James Bond film, which... I don't know, to me was incredibly long, although good movie. We'll be talking about some movie news, including Aaron Sorkin's plans for the Steve Jobs biopic that he's writing. Then there's the news that Warner Brothers has agreed to release 20 additional films in IMAX, which I know, Michael, pleases you to no end. There was also some big news in the world of televised sports with News Corp, you know, that little company run by Rupert Murdoch. Well, they're becoming a part of the Yankees, or maybe it's the other way around. Whatever the case, the cost of licensing sports for television is out of control, according to some cable bigwigs. We'll explain. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And as always, we'll cover the weekend box office around the world. So we won't be including the five-day numbers that include Thanksgiving, which is obviously one of the biggest holidays of the year for movie going.
In the U.S.
And we'll be covering the three-day weekend around the world. And then the total box office figures will, of course, include that five-day extravaganza here in the U.S. And, of course, some movies that we missed last week when they opened. So here we go. The number one movie around the world opened 2 weekends ago. Massive hit. The Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn, Part 2. It grossed $140 million worldwide. It's at $577 million and counting. It's galloping towards the roughly $700 million that the last three films in the Twilight Saga all grossed. So we'll have to see where it ends up. It'll probably end up a little bit past that, but it'll be interesting to see if it collapses really quickly next weekend and the weekend after, because everybody's seen it who wants to see it.
Well, and all the other films have kind of collapsed pretty much after the first 2 weeks.
Right. They've been very front-loaded.
Yes.
This one has been doing extraordinary business overseas, which took a little bit of catching up to the U.S. to how big a phenomenon the books were. But the last three films all grossed within about $20 million, all grossed $700 million. So one would expect this to make at least $700 million. I don't think you can go that much beyond it, but we'll have to see. It's already at almost $600 million, and it grossed $140 million this weekend. So number two around the world is another record setter. It's Skyfall, the James Bond film, which was not a minute too short as far as I'm concerned. I thought it was very good. It grossed $77 million worldwide. That does not include some territories that are missing. That's the figures that are from Sony, but some of the MGM territories, the rights are split on this movie, they're not coming in yet. So we're a little short on that total budget. It's more than $77 million this weekend, but we don't know the exact amount. But worldwide, we know James Bond has grossed $790 million. That's, of course, a record for foreign gross, a record for domestic gross, a record for worldwide gross, not adjusting for inflation.
It's the second highest grossing film in the UK, 2D film.
I think it could pass Titanic. It probably will and become the highest grossing film in UK history.
Right. And you said it's not a minute too short. You meant a minute too long.
Or long or short. It's nuts. It's not a minute too short or long. It's just right.
Kind of like our podcast. Not a minute too long.
Or short. Number three around the world is the Ang Lee film Life of Pi, based on the best-selling Booker Prize-winning novel, God Knows Why. It grossed $39 million worldwide. It's at $47 million and counting. It overperformed over Thanksgiving holiday. It's doing quite well, getting good reviews. It'll probably be in the mix for Oscar, I guess. I saw it and I didn't like it, but, you know, who knows?
Well, and I know that, you know, something that's very important to you is how much the movie made on 3D screens, and that was 68% of the box office.
Which is about right for an opening weekend. I mean, that's what you'd expect, correct? I mean, you certainly wouldn't want to see anything less than 50%.
Right. I mean, ideally, you would see 50% because most of the time, these screenings are cut 50-50. So you have four screenings in 2D, four screenings in 3D, so 50% would be good.
Well, no, but I mean, if you spend the money to make a movie in 3D, you expect more people to want to see it in 3D.
Oh, yes.
Otherwise, there'd be no point. So, no, you don't expect it to be a 50-50 split. Anything less than 50-50 would be disastrous. It's more than 50-50 that you expect, right?
Right. So if that's what you're saying, movies, yeah. Then I agree with you.
Did you see it in 3D?
I have not seen this film yet. I've seen, I've seen probably about 50 minutes of it and in different bits and pieces at different meetings, but I have not seen the whole thing put together in one movie.
I don't recommend it. It's not very good. I don't like the 3D at all. I think the 3D is very shticky and jokey and makes Ang Lee, who can be a terrific filmmaker, do sort of cheap things like having the tiger leap out at you. It's a film, of course, about a young man trapped on a raft with a Bengal tiger, and they both try to survive. And so every once in a while, the tiger lunges, you know, or a stick comes out at you like it's an old, you know, Hollywood 3D movie from the 50s. I think it looks cheesy. I don't like the look of the film. I think it looks very, very over the top pretty and not in a good way. It's kind of hard to see sometimes what's going on. I think the 3D is gimmicky, and I think it hurts the film, pulls you out of the reality of what you're watching, actually. I'd actually like to see it in 2D. I think it might be slightly more effective, though I don't think it's a good movie in general. I think it'll probably fade a bit. I doubt it'll get a lot of Oscar love, but you never know. It's a strong commercial opening for it, so we'll have to see.
Well, and a film that didn't do very well in 3D is your number four film here worldwide.
That's right, Rise of the Guardians. That's a DreamWorks animated film. It's the last movie in the deal between DreamWorks and Paramount. They're ending their deal with Paramount and going to Fox, I think, right?
That is correct.
That's correct. So Rise of the Guardians opened over the Thanksgiving weekend. It grossed $34 million worldwide. It's at $45 million and counting to date. And this three-day weekend opening, depends how you slice and dice it, looking at the U.S., North American three-day, five-day weekend, because it is a holiday weekend. But there's no question this is a very disappointing opening. It's their lowest opener since, I think, Flushed Away, which was the animated film that starred the voice of Hugh Jackman. That opened in 2006. So it's been 6 years since they've had an animated film open this poorly. So not a good start. However, they do say, hey, this is a holiday-themed movie. It's got Santa Claus and all these characters fighting evil. They all come together in a superhero type team to fight evil, and they think it's going to have legs and play all the way through the Christmas season, much like Polar Express and some other movies have done in the past. It could happen, but a very bad sign, like you say, is that only 35% of its opening weekend gross came from 3D, that's very low.
Well, and I liked what Anne Globe, DreamWorks Animation's chief of marketing, said. She says, and I know you'll love this, Michael, because you always say it, it's not where you start. It's where you finish.
That's true. And she said, hey, if it has legs, you all won't be worried about the opening. You can't get too caught up in the opening weekend. But analysts and investors care, I think, too much. I wouldn't go crazy on MGM stock just because, you know, James Bond opened strong. But the stock of DreamWorks Animation dropped because of this opening weekend. It's their worst opening weekend in 6 years. And people sold the stock and said, uh-oh, they're not going to be making a lot of money on this movie. And they sold their stock. So it does have an effect. But I think she's right. We'll have to see. Didn't get great reviews. Nobody went to see it in 3D. So it's not a good start. There's no way around that. But we'll see how it holds next weekend. And number five is a movie that expanded a little bit. It's doing quite well. It's Lincoln, the film by Steven Spielberg. It grossed $25 million worldwide. It's at $62 million and counting, mostly in North America. This is a very strong, wide-release expansion for a movie. It did quite well with adults over the weekend. People went to it during the holiday season. And we'll see if it shows legs and starts to get end of the award critics nominations and, you know, honors from all those sort of groups, and then Oscar nominations. So this could have a long life in front of it.
Well, you know, it's that film about the capital of Nebraska, right?
That's right. It's about Abraham Lincoln and the abolishing of slavery, the passing of the 13th Amendment. And number six is Wreck-It Ralph, another animated film. This is doing pretty well. It grossed $90 million worldwide. It's at $190 million and counting. And number seven, finally, the remake of Red Dawn came out. It came out over Thanksgiving because nothing says Thanksgiving like a bunch of kids shooting up North Korean invaders. it sat on the shelf for years because MGM went into bankruptcy. It was a remake of an early 80s film that had a lot of young rising stars like Patrick Swayze and C. Thomas Howell. This movie also ended up having a lot of smart casting with talent like Chris Hemsworth, is that his name?
Yes.
Who plays Thor?
Yes.
And the kid from Hunger Games,
oh, okay.
Josh Hutcherson, quite a talented young actor. He's Team PETA, of course. And this movie made $14 million worldwide over the weekend. It's at $22 million in counting. It could have been a disaster, but it actually opened okay, meaning it might do okay on DVD and that sort of thing. I actually went to see it. I don't know why. As I tweeted, I said, you know, the original Red Dawn was silly fun, but remaking it is just silly.
Oh, so. That's a good tweet. That's under 140 characters. It's kind of right to the point. I love it.
Thank you very much. And number eight is the Ben Affleck film, still chugging along, is Argo. It grossed another $10 million worldwide. It's at $148 million and counting. Excellent numbers for a movie that they say cost about $45 million to make. And it's certainly going to be in the mix for Oscar, just as is the number nine film, Flight, directed by Robert Zemeckis and starring Denzel Washington. It made another $9 million worldwide. It did open in a few very small markets overseas, but its overseas campaign will wait till the award season begins in December and January. It has grossed $78 million worldwide. And number 10, another Oscar hopeful, because that's the season, Silver Linings Playbook, the David O. Russell film. It expanded a bit, did not do great, but it's doing okay. It grossed $7 million worldwide. It started to open overseas as well, and it's at $9 million and counting. But the people who like this movie like it a lot, so don't rule it out for, you know, Oscar. You know, it's definitely going to be in the mix for that as well.
I want to go back to Flight that you said would be in the mix for Oscar nominations and award nominations. Why do you say that?
Well, because it got good reviews. Robert Zemeckis is beloved by the Academy. No matter what he does, they seem to give it a lot of attention. Denzel is one of the most dependable stars in Hollywood. He has an amazing track record of opening movies. He's the most bankable guy you can think of. He makes a movie, people go see it opening weekend. It's Oscar bait type material about an airline pilot suffering from alcoholism. It has a flashy opener. I didn't like the film. I thought Denzel was good in it. I wouldn't nominate him for Best Actor, but I can respect his work in it. But I didn't like the film. I think it's sort of a glorified TV movie, and that's an insult to good TV movies. I think it could fade from memory, but given their track record of Zemeckis and Denzel, it's very possible in this year that, especially with the expanded Oscar list, you don't know how many movies there are going to be on the list, but it depends. If there's a big front runner, if there's one or two movies that everybody thinks is going to win and thinks they love, then you're less likely to have 7, 8, or 9 movies on the list. But when there's no clear front runner and you've got a lot of loyalty split, that's when you get movies like Flight and Zero Dark Thirty and The Master will be on the list much more likely. So, we'll have to see what happens. But the one thing I question, though, is that they say Flight costs $31 million to make.
Yeah.
They say the budget for Flight is $31 million.
How is that possible? How is that even possible?
In what universe is that movie $31 million? Because it's Denzel and Robert Zemeckis. Those two alone are going to make $30 million on the movie.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't buy that.
It's clearly the below-the-line cost, right?
It must be.
At best.
How do you spend $31 million making Flight with A-list talent like that? I don't buy it. Yeah.
Right. It's got to be the below-line cost because it has one big flight crash, which obviously costs a lot. But other than that, it's a simple film. It's a lot of interiors. It's not an elaborate movie with a lot of different sets. They don't travel a lot. So I can see why that wouldn't cost a lot. There aren't a lot of big names in it. It's Denzel. John Goodman is not going to cost a lot of money. And some other talented actors, but not hugely expensive names. But those two alone, clearly, their cut of the profits, their salaries, whatever deferred payment they took or a cut of the gross, clearly, you're going to spend at least $20, $30 million on those two. So that's wishful thinking. As is Lincoln. They say Lincoln's budget was $65 million. $65 million for a period film set in the Civil War, directed by Steven Spielberg? How is that possible?
I don't buy that either. I think a movie like that, I mean, I don't know where they're getting these figures from. And
the
they, in this
case, the studios giving these figures out.
Yeah.
So the question is, what are they up to? you know, there used to be a period when studios wanted to talk up their big budgets because that made it sound like a big movie. They're like, oh, it's a $120 million film. Now, there seems to be a big trend of them wanting to show sort of responsibility and lean budgets. That seems to be the trend in the last year or two.
Well, we're in a worldwide recession, right? Or coming out of one. So you don't want to walk around going, hey, come and see that Hollywood film, you know, where we throw money around like it's nothing.
Well, I think they're talking more to investors, don't you? And the industry. I don't think they're talking to the public.
Well, true.
Right. Well, so what other news do we have about movies?
Well, you know, since we're talking about box office, I guess we could say that here in the United States, you mentioned that it was the Thanksgiving holiday. It was the highest grossing Thanksgiving holiday on record, $290 million, I think, for the top 10 films. And or maybe it's the top 50. I don't know. $290 million beat out the $270 million that was made in 2009. So
we're number one. Okay.
Okay, yeah. Well, speaking of number one, look at Sony Pictures. You know, we're talking about Skyfall there. Well, mm-hmm. Skyfall, along with movies like Hotel Transylvania, the Amazing Spider-Man, Men in Black 3, and even 21 Jump Street, they are having a $4 billion year. They have made $4 billion this year, internationally, over at Sony Pictures. That's
worldwide.
Remarkable. Worldwide, yes. So
that's huge. Has anybody ever passed $4 billion before?
I don't know. That's a good question. I know here in the United States, they've made $1.6 billion.
So if they're making a lot of money, why are they postponing the release of Zero Dark Thirty, the film about the hunt for Osama bin Laden? That's come from Catherine Bigelow, who won the Best Picture Oscar for directing The Hurt Locker just a few years ago.
Well, you had a very interesting theory during the pre-show that you said that, look, you know, they released Skyfall in November. They wanted to focus their marketing efforts on Skyfall. And then come December, hey, you know, we can focus our efforts on Zero Dark Thirty, give it a big Oscar push, open it up in limited release on, you know, in and around Christmas, and then open it wider in January. Seems to be a smart play. But, you know, you talk to people over at Sony Pictures, or at least those working on the Sony Pictures lot, and they're all talking about how Sony is just, they're just spending less money because of all the trouble and the red ink that Sony Electronics, the parent company of Sony Pictures, is having.
But you would think the division that's making money would be the division that would get money.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody always says, oh, well, Sony Electronics isn't a part of Sony, you know, Sony Pictures isn't really a part of the bigger company, but at the end of the day, it is.
Right. Of course, if the parent company is floundering, but I don't know why you would cut the budget of the one division that's making money.
Well, I think they're just being smarter about how they spend it, and to do that, they're trimming back.
Well, I think Zero Dark Thirty is smarter to platform off critics' notices, because you're going to need that. It's 2.5 hours long. It's basically a woman staring at a computer screen, I think, for 2.5 hours as they track down Osama bin Laden. There is a recreation of the actual, mission to take him out, but it's essentially an intellectual thriller, I guess. So it's not a shoot 'em up by any stretch of the imagination. It's a political thriller in a way. So it needs that critical support. I don't think you want to open it up in December 14th next to The Hobbit.
No.
Or something like that. So I think it is a classic sort of movie. Jessica Chastain in a starring role. It's the first time she's been asked to carry a movie. So there's a lot of firsts on this. And I think it makes sense to try and platform it and open it in January when there's a little bit less pressure.
And you may have said this already, but it's by the same team, Catherine Bigelow and I want to say Mark Bowles, the writer of The Hurt Locker and the director of The Hurt Locker.
That's right, which was one of the lowest grossing Oscar winning films of all time. They would like to turn that trend around with Zero Dark Thirty.
Right, it made $12 million. Now, here's a film that probably didn't make $12 million, but apparently somebody found the earliest surviving Hitchcock film ever.
Well, it's not a film he directed, though, is it? It's a film. It's the earliest film he has credits on that they found a copy of.
Right, I guess he was the assistant director.
He was assistant director. He was, what else was he? He was
art director, editor, and writer.
Yeah. I guess he didn't do a cameo, but other than that, he did pretty much everything else.
Right, the earliest existence of a multi-hyphenate.
Yes, what's it called?
It is called The White Shadow. It's from 1924, and unfortunately, they only have the first three out of the six reels of this silent film, so about 43 minutes.
I thought reels were 20 minutes long.
Well, I think it depended on, it's 1924, so no, they could be a little bit shorter. 10 minutes, uh-huh. 10, 15 minutes.
Okay. So it's probably like a 90-minute film, and we have about half of it.
That's right.
And where can people see it?
They can actually see it online, from what I understand. over at the, I can't remember where. Oh, it's the National Film Preservation Foundation's website.
Oh, that's cool.
And I guess they found this thing in, I guess, an old cache of American nitrate prints in the New Zealand Film Archive, because that's where all American nitrate prints go
that
to.
That's true, though. We keep finding stuff in New Zealand. I remember some other film recently where they got prints in New Zealand. That seems to be a wonderful source. They apparently got all their movies and nobody bothered to ship them back because they didn't want to spend the money, frankly.
Right. Well, it was also nitrate, so it wasn't a very, very stable medium either. You don't want to be shipping back something that's going to explode.
So that's kind of cool.
But now, okay, so we're talking now about a film from 1924, probably shot on 35 millimeter and very small frame. But now, these days, people are shooting, well, they're still shooting on 35 and using digital equipment. But people like Christopher Nolan, they're using IMAX cameras. They're shooting 65 millimeter, 70 millimeter films and releasing films that way. And of course, there's a whole bunch of people that are just blowing films up to be put on IMAX. And Warner Brothers has been a big advocate of IMAX, so much so that they now are going to release an additional 20 films over the next 3 years.
Right. They're not making films in IMAX. We're not talking about what Nolan did with The Dark Knight Returns, where he actually filmed a significant portion of the movie in IMAX. We're talking about movies that are just shot in whatever other format, but are blown up and shown on an IMAX screen so people pay extra for the exciting IMAX experience. Now, you say the sound quality on IMAX screen is great.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Right. It's better than you get in any other environment.
Well, I think in most other environments, yes.
Right. Well, movie theaters where you're paying money as a moviegoer to see it, you're going to get better sound if you go to the IMAX screening, right?
Absolutely, yes.
But the visual experience, I say, is a nightmare. Unless it's shot in IMAX, it's not really a good way to see a feature film.
Well, and a lot of these IMAX screens, I mean, certainly there's FIMAX or LIMAX or whatever.
That's even worse. That's where they pretend it's IMAX. They brand it with IMAX. They put it on a screen. It's not shot on IMAX, and it's not shown on an IMAX screen, but they charge you a premium for it.
Right.
So Warner Brothers is saying, yes, let's double down on fraud.
Whoa. Before the lawyers from Warner Brothers call us.
Call me up, baby, and let's go to court. I would love it. I would love it. Go in court. Did you shoot it in IMAX? No. Is it an IMAX screen as defined by what IMAX actually is? No. So why is it called IMAX? Because we have the right to call it IMAX.
That's right, because of the licensing. Well, and I think there are a lot more. Well, and they're calling it the IMAX experience.
Oh, it's an experience. Reach into your wallet and give them more money. And what are the movies they're going to show in this IMAX experience?
Well, there's Jack the Giant Slayer.
Oh, that's depressing. I can't talk about that movie.
Man of Steel, which is a Christopher Nolan related film. It's the Superman film that he's producing.
Right.
Zack Snyder's directing. The Pacific Rim, or Pacific Rim. 300, Rise of an Empire.
A sequel to 300. That took a long time to go. Well, I don't know how they're doing it anyway. They all died. But yeah, we'll have to see.
It's not giving anything away. It's, yeah.
What the heck is Gravity?
I have no idea. Gravity, Seventh Son.
No, that's two different movies,
oh,
isn't
it?
Oh, no, it's
no
not.
Idea.
Okay, and The Hobbit, of course, the second part of The Hobbit. That's an IMAX this December 14th. So we got a lot of big movies. None of those, I believe, were shot in IMAX. Certainly not a majority of the film. So they're all, anybody, please, do not pay money to go see a movie in IMAX unless a big chunk of the film was shot in IMAX. Star Trek, we know a chunk of that movie was shot in IMAX. The Star Trek sequel, there'll be 9 minutes of it shown in front of the IMAX screening of The Hobbit.
That's right.
Which is terrible, because it means if I want to see 9 minutes of Star Trek 7 months before it comes out, I got to buy another ticket to The Hobbit to see in a format I don't want to see. So I'm a little torn by that. I might go see The Hobbit. I am. I've already purchased a ticket to see it in the 48 frames per second 3D, you know, presentation. I want to see it in 2D to be able to compare it to the 2D, 3D, and 48 frames per second. And I may now have to see it in IMAX in order to see the Star Trek thing. So, you know, that's what I do for you.
Well, you know what? So December 14th, ladies and gentlemen, we will not be having an episode because Michael will be spending a week inside a movie theater.
That's right. So seriously, I convinced my brother to stop paying money to go see a movie in IMAX. I convinced him, look, it's the same. It's just a slightly bigger screen. You're paying a lot of extra money. It's not shot on IMAX. It's not being shown on IMAX. And if it was, it'd be a kind of an awkward, awful experience anyway, because a seven-story tall screen where you're looking back and forth to try and follow the action isn't actually a good way to see a movie unless it's shot in IMAX. So I've convinced him and his family. They have kids. They used to go to movies. I've convinced them not to go to the IMAX screening anymore, and now they're happy. They're like, yeah, I don't know why we were doing that.
Apparently, so you also convinced them not to see Rise of the Guardians in 3D.
Yes. Well, certainly, they like most people, they're, you know, down on 3D, but we've covered that before. So what movie will not be shown on IMAX? Steve Jobs biopic, I imagine.
I would imagine you're right. Now, this is, I believe, a Sony film that Aaron Sorkin is writing. Of course, he wrote The Social Network, which really has no relation to the Steve Jobs biopic, other than the fact that both are about, you know, tech, I suppose. But he was talking at a Daily Beast conference, or a conference that was put on by the Daily Beast, and he says that the Steve Jobs biopic that he's writing, based on the Walter Isaacson bio that was published right around the time of Mr. Jobs' passing, he says, quote, "It is going to be three scenes, and three scenes only, that all take place in real time."
But what I heard that, and I thought, oh, that sounds like a stunt. But what's fascinating is they're all set right around the product launches.
Right. So they're all set backstage around the product launches of the Mac. So that was like the big 1984 unveiling. The next, which was Jobs' post-Mac career, and I think in the early 90s is when he launched that.
When he was down at sort of his low point of his career. He thought he was launching a great new product that ended up not doing well.
Well, it was a great product. Unfortunately, it was so expensive that nobody bought it.
Right.
And then a product that was very expensive that everybody did buy, the iPod, that would be the final product launch.
I wouldn't say that was expensive.
Well, initially it was. Initially it was like $400 or $500 for a 5 gigabyte.
No.
Oh, yeah. It was very expensive.
Well, I bought it. I didn't pay $500 for it. That's for sure.
No, it came down in price very, very quickly within the first like 6 to 8 months.
So Steve Jobs is famous for his product launches, for the dazzling demonstrations he makes, and to say, all right, these are the key moments in his career, the original, you know, launch of the Mac, his time in the wilderness, which is next, and then the iPod, which was the beginning of his second success story, where he exploded with the iPod, and then, of course, what came next?
Well,
the iPhone, of course.
Yeah,
the iPhone, the tablet, the revamping of Mac into Apple into a huge, huge company, dominating the industry. So that's kind of fascinating. It'd be interesting to see that one.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me more like a David Mamet one-person play, like one-man show.
Well, but there'll be a lot of people back there.
Yeah, I don't. It's just, how do you do that? It'll be interesting to see how he pulls it off. If there's anybody that can pull it off, it's Aaron Sorkin.
I mean, yeah, you're right. It cost $400 to buy the 5-gig model back in 2001.
I can't believe you were looking that up this whole time.
I believe you.
Okay.
I just wanted to check.
Well, now let me ask. I mean, so you're thinking, it's, you know, this format is not really all that. It's not a big deal that he's going to limit it to three scenes that are in real time.
No, not at all. It is a big deal because it's a stunt. It's a flourish. How do you do someone's life? He's picked three key points, all linked thematically in a way. I think it's an interesting structure for a movie to talk about Steve Jobs. It makes a lot of sense once you start to think about it. It'll be interesting to see how he does it. So I think it's a big deal creatively.
Ooh, well then, if you think that's a big deal, maybe we should move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, which is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment, and we tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, get this, Michael. NBC has won the November sweeps in the key 18 to 49 demographic for the first time in a decade.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's thanks to, I believe that, you know, that little show Whitney. No, it's thanks to Sunday Night Football and The Voice, as well as freshman shows Revolution and Matthew Perry's Go On. CBS still one-handedly in total viewers, where NBC is in third place. The last time NBC won November sweeps was back in 2002 when it had hits like Friends, ER, The West Wing, Will and Grace, Frasier, and not one, not two, but three Law and Orders. All of those shows were in the top 20. Every other network is down substantially this year in total viewers and the 18 to 49 demo. NBC is the only one to improve. Big deal or big whoop? It's kind of a big deal, so should we just move on to the next story?
It's a very big deal for two reasons. One is the paucity of hits for which they did it. The network viewing is so depressed. That's one reason why just having Sunday Night Football and the pre- and post-game shows and The Voice on two nights a week can make such a huge difference for one network. And NBC was so far down, it had nowhere to go but up. But when you look at the list of two shows, The Voice and football, compared to that string of creative and commercial hits that they had back in 2002, you can see the massive difference in the depth of their bench, the quality of the shows they're putting on, the success that they have right now, what they can look forward to down the road. There's no comparison. That this is more of a fluke. Not that NBC won't win again next sweeps, but, you know, they're going to burn out The Voice and end up with just football again in about 2 years. So, you know, this is not an exciting win. This is a sad reflection of the depressed viewing for all networks and a sad reflection of NBC state. Even when they win in the 18 to 49 demo, it's with a pretty lackluster crowd of shows. But what really shocks me is that they announced a November sweeps winner based on the live viewing plus same day reruns on DVR.
So they're not counting three days.
It's the November sweeps. They can wait till early. Why would they not include live plus three, which is what advertisers pay for, or live plus seven to include everybody watching the show? Why wouldn't they want to include all that information? To me, that's a complete distortion. I feel like, well, I don't even know what the number one show of the sweeps was. I don't know how shows rank compared to each other. I don't even know which networks won, really, if you're not going to include live plus three or live plus seven. To me, it makes the analysis of the whole November sweeps ridiculous. We know the sweep season is a joke anyway. They should not be basing ad rates on what happens for, you know, 4 weeks in the middle of the year.
Well, maybe the FCC can do something about that.
Yeah, but that to me is bizarre that they do not include me, because most shows I don't, you know, I watched The Walking Dead last night right away, but a lot of shows I take a day or two to watch. So to not include all those viewers and declare this show a winner, it seems bizarre to me. It's like declaring to win the election before you've counted all the votes.
We would never do that. Well, I mentioned the FCC because the FCC is chipping away at cross-ownership rules. And those are the regulations that keep major media players from owning a TV station, newspaper, and radio station all in the same markets. The idea is that too much media power in the hands of one company is dangerous and bad for the public, or should we go back to the 1930s and 40s in Europe, which is pretty much what happened there, and propaganda was... Anyway, media companies are constantly pushing for the right to cross-own more properties, and with newspapers collapsing financially, the FCC is proposing to end the ban on owning newspapers and radio stations in the same market, with the idea that maybe a newspaper-radio combination would help them both survive. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. Anytime you see cross-ownership being chipped away at, it's a big deal because it's one of the few things that has allowed a few more voices to get out, maybe, sort of. But newspapers are going out of business. So, hey, you know, if radio stations and newspapers can partner up, and you can use the newspaper content on the radios and the radio platform to bring attention to the newspaper, you know, pretty much everybody has thrown up their hands and said, well, in this case, we all agree this is okay. One of the big advocate groups is the minority owners of media, and they dropped their objections to dropping the cross-ownership between radio and newspapers because they recognize the poor economic market for newspapers and how they're struggling to survive. So if a few people can pick up a newspaper and keep it in business for a few years longer, the idea is maybe it's not such a bad thing. You got to reflect the reality of the world we live in today.
And in future episodes of Showbiz Sandbox, we will be talking about how News Corp and Rupert Murdoch have purchased every newspaper in America.
Yeah, it's scary. There's too much concentration of media power in a few companies, but this perhaps, I guess we get so used to that that we just accept this blithely.
Well, now, Michael, did you know that The Hollywood Reporter, speaking of, well, a trade newspaper, if you will, they were one of the key movers in establishing the blacklist in Hollywood. That is the campaign that began by denouncing 10 industry talents for refusing to cooperate with Joseph McCarthy's witch hunt for communists and ended by destroying careers, lives, and forcing people to leave the country. This was all back in the 1950s.
I knew nothing about this.
Neither did I, actually. The blacklist was spearheaded by the trade paper's owner, Billy Wilkerson, but has received scant notice over the years, with The Hollywood Reporter itself naturally eager to put the sordid time behind it. But on the 65th anniversary of that affair, it has written a lengthy feature on what happened and included an apology from Wilkerson's son, as well as talking to any survivors willing to speak with them. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but it's a fascinating little look into Hollywood history. We have a link to the article, which is quite lengthy. It's like 3 or 4 page turns. I don't know how you describe that on a website. 3 or 4 page views. I don't know what you say, but it's substantial. And it's fascinating. And Billy Wilkerson's kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
Kind of a hateful son of a bitch. Oh, sorry about that, kids. And but it's very interesting. And I had no idea, but he was really a major factor in it.
Yes.
And it's really interesting to read. So anybody interested in Hollywood history or the, you know, the Hollywood 10 and all that stuff, it's well worth taking the time to check out.
Is the Hollywood 10 like the Chicago 8?
Exactly.
Now, actor Larry Hagman, best known for his roles as the astronaut on I Dream of Jeannie and J.R. Ewing on the primetime soap Dallas, he died unexpectedly over the Thanksgiving holiday. Hagman was part of the Dallas reboot currently airing on TNT and had filmed 6 out of the new season's 15 episodes.
He died in Dallas, by the way, so how fitting is that?
I know. I
surrounded by Linda Gray, who played his wife on the TV show along with a lot of other family and friends, but my God, it's unbelievable.
Well, now producers are scrambling to figure out how to rework the rest of the season, adjust scripts, and give JR a proper goodbye. In my opinion, they should just shoot him. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you have to know your Dallas history.
No, that's, everybody knows their Dallas history. That was good.
Yeah. Hagman had been a heavy drinker and needed a liver transplant in 1995. He also had a bout of cancer recently, which he described as treatable. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal to his family and friends, obviously, and it's a big deal to the show, which has been a modest success on TNT. You know, we'd known he'd been ailing for years, and all the older cast members were so old, I kind of wondered, even before I heard about this, whether they said, hey, let's film a death scene, JR. What do you think? I guess that's a ginger topic to approach him on. But I might have said, hey, let's just film one. He said, we'll have it in the can ready to go whenever we want to do that. You know, an actor might have been game for that. You know, he's getting on in years. But I guess you can't go up to him and say, hey, in case you die, how about we shoot a scene where you die in the show? But clearly they had no expectations of this. They aren't prepared. The older cast members who might have just had cameos on the show, they're actually real characters and have storylines, and JR is there a lot. His scenes are very simple. He's usually sitting down, people coming to talk to him. You know, it's not complicated stuff for an older man to do, but, you know, he's been a presence on the show, so it's going to be tricky to work him out.
Well, could he be like Charlie and Charlie's Angels, where you just see his hand in the back of his head?
Yeah, no, they're going to, I mean, I'm sure they'll carry him on for an episode or two, but whether it'll be fun to see whether they kill him off or you know, have somebody murder him or what they do with it. They can't obviously do a JR thing as much, you know, who shot JR, but they can have some fun with it. I think that would be in the spirit of him and the character.
Well, here's another example of trademark and copyright foolishness. We should actually have our own segment for that now. A German company that specializes in puzzles, but also makes a board game called simply Memory. They have trademarked the word, get this, memory. In 42 countries, although not in the U.S.
I forgot this.
Yeah. At their demand, Apple is telling anyone offering an app in those countries that they must not use the word memory in their title, even if the app itself has no relation to the board game that the German company is selling. So some 50 apps, such as Preschool Memory Match, will be affected. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal in idiocy, I guess, is the only way to put it. I guess Cats, the musical, will have to watch out when it sings memory anytime. You know, I think that's memories, but who knows? It's just crazy. I mean, we see this all the time. I mean, memory? What about brain or food or cookbook or where? What about the word where? I mean, it's just...
Is it memory in German, or is it memory, the word memory in English?
I don't know. Good question.
Because I know there was another German company that, like, kind of had a trademark suit over Metro, which was the new operating system of Windows 8, had the Metro style, you know, look. And they said, oh, you can't call it Metro because some German company is, and I could be wrong, maybe it's not German, maybe it's Dutch, I don't know, but there was some company that came out of the woodwork and said, oh, we own that, the trademark to that word.
Metro, as in Metropolitan.
Yes.
And again, if it was a board game, if it was an app that mimicked the game that they were doing, you'd say, all right, they're going to confuse the two. But the idea that the word memory is copyrightable seems kind of stupid to us.
Right. And same thing with Metro. I mean, the Mets immediately changed their name to Last Place, I believe.
Nice.
And I'm a Mets fan, believe it or not. In any case.
I believe that.
A move that shocked absolutely nobody. The British TV network ITV has renewed the primetime soap Downton Abbey for a 4th season.
What?
Yes. I know you're shocked, Michael. Try and sit down for this one. But the current season, its 3rd, just wrapped up in the UK with record ratings for both the season overall and the season finale. Fans are also looking forward to a 2-hour special on Christmas Day, which happens to be the biggest day of the year for TV viewing in Great Britain. Do not ask me why. In America, season 3 begins on January 6th. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. I mean, of course, why didn't they renew it for a 5th season at the same time? I mean, what's the wait? The only question is Maggie Smith part of the cast for the 4th season? I guess that's the only thing we don't really know, since I've avoided all plot twists from season three, though I imagine if she dies, it'll be on the Christmas special. But Christmas Day is a big day in the UK. It's just a long time tradition. Families are together. And at some point, networks started showing family-friendly programming to give families something to watch on Christmas Day. People used to stay at home, you know, on Christmas Day. They didn't always go to the movies. And so in the UK, it started to become a tradition where, like, a big soap or a big drama, they'd have a special episode that they aired on Christmas Day, and there'd be a Christmas-themed episode even. So now you have Doctor Who and Downton Abbey and, you know, Coronation Street, and any show you can think of would often come up with a big Christmas Day special because all the networks are vying for bragging rights to have to win the crown of the most popular show on Christmas Day. So it becomes a day with just a wealth of really fun episodes and specials to catch. So it's, you know, it's a great day. Just like November sweeps is this artificial reason to have big specials and programming in the networks. Christmas Day is an artificial reason. Families are together. They want to create family-friendly programming. And it's just a rich, I love it. I love it. I've been to the UK and I want to tape the entire day on every network and watch them all because it's always fun.
YouTube launched dozens of channels with much ballyhoo and $100 million in funding. Enough cat videos, they said. YouTube wanted real content from real talent. 1 year later, YouTube is claiming success. They've launched 60 new channels, and while most of the original ones flopped, they say 30 to 40% of them will get more funding. The top 25 new channels average more than 1 million views a week and are slowly building an audience for a new way of getting programming to viewers. It's called the internet. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. They're doubling down on their bet. You know, 30% of them are worth funding for a second season, if that's how we can call it. I think that's a pretty darn good success rate. So this is a really interesting experiment. Everybody needs content, original content, to bring people to them. YouTube has had people always coming to them, but they realize they want special, unique stuff that they can guarantee won't be anywhere else. And that's what they're doing here. They see Vimeo and other competitors coming up on the, you know, Facebook and other things. And so they've seen, hey, we need original content. We're going to pay for it. We're going to do it. And they're starting to get some traction. I get PR releases all the time about stuff on YouTube. I mean, I never got that a year ago.
So you get like PR release, man falls off skateboard, come see the video.
No, it's about sitcoms and dramas and cookbook shows and movie review shows. And it's all sorts of content. And I get it all the time now. I don't really watch any of it yet. And I haven't gone to any of the channels particularly. But you can see that they're, you know, they're making an effort. They're trying it out. They're going to try building on it. Hey, if I can turn the FX channel to catch a show, why can't I turn to YouTube?
Well, speaking of channels. Stars is a new channel fighting to gain audience and traction with critics and, you know, audiences, too. You wouldn't think they could even afford to cancel a critically acclaimed TV show that had already won a top Golden Globe Award. But that's exactly what happened to Boss, the drama starring Kelsey Grammer. The show opened to soft ratings, even by the standards of Stars, and it only went lower from there. The channel adjusted the premiere date for season two to make certain it faced no competition anywhere. Posted the first episode online and did everything else to beat the drums for the show about a corrupt mayor of Chicago. But ratings kept deflating with no end in sight and the plug was pulled. Hey, maybe they can go to YouTube. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. You know, show gets canceled. Show with poor ratings gets canceled. It's kind of sad. I've got season one on my DVD player. I'm just about to launch into it. I just watched Homeland, which was a lot of fun. And I was looking forward to watching Boss. I knew season two was airing. And now I'm like, oh, they've canceled it. So now I feel a little deflated. Like, do I even bother? You know, this is sort of the impact that you have on a show. You know, I was excited by the show. It got great reviews. It was a surprise it didn't get an Emmy nomination. He could have been nominated for Best Actor or Best Drama, and he didn't make the cut. And he might have made it in season two. I don't know. But I think that was a real factor. If it had gotten those Emmy nominations, because the Golden Globes, they just don't have the same cachet.
No, not
so
at all.
If they'd gotten an Emmy nomination, if they'd gotten that success, that might have shamed them or kept them excited enough to put it into a season three. But you look at what they did, you look at the premiere numbers and how it kept dropping steadily every week, every season. You know, they kind of did everything they could. They saw, you know, there was not even a leveling out. Usually you look for a show to sort of level out. Like, even if it starts low, you at least want to know the audience that's watching stays with it. In this case, they were not holding onto a core audience. So I can't really fault them for it, though it's certainly a shame because, you know, Kelsey Grammer is easily his best show from all the reviews and ratings that I understand, easily his best show since Frasier.
Well, you know, being canceled is a sure way to get deleted from my DVR. In any case, speaking of getting deleted from my DVR.
Do you still have that dinosaur show on your DVR?
No, I canceled that. Or
oh, you finally deleted it?
Yeah, no, yeah. I deleted it. Yeah.
What was it called?
Terra Nova.
Terra Nova. Thank you.
But I was going to move on to Chevy Chase, and not Marilyn, but the actor who is abruptly leaving the sitcom community. And I don't mean the sitcom community. I mean the sitcom community. In the middle of its fourth and likely final season, Chase butted heads with the show's creator, Dan Harmon, repeatedly over the years and constantly voiced his displeasure with anything and pretty much everything. Harmon was rather bizarrely kicked out even as the show was renewed for a fourth season, which made almost no sense since the series was hanging on by a thread and its entire sensibility came from Dan Harmon. So it might have seemed like a fresh start for Chase, who also famously was the first to leave Saturday Night Live, by the way. Instead, Chase continued to make life miserable for everyone, used a racial slur and an angry tirade on the set recently, for which he immediately apologized, and has now bolted with just a few episodes left to film. He can't even finish college. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop, man leaves show. Of course, Karen is still in my head from her visit last week or the week before, the last episode we had. But this is just like the final FU to Dan Harmon. You know, He's forced to leave the show, and then Chase leaves a few episodes later, just like, yeah, I wanted to leave anyway, but I want to make sure you left first. I mean, good God. That just seems so petty.
Did you hear what he says about, this is Chevy Chase, about the show itself? He says, it was a big mistake. I just sort of hung around because I have three daughters and a wife, and I figured out I might as well make some bread every week so I can take care of them in the way they want. The hours are hideous, and it's still a sitcom on television, which is probably the lowest form of television.
Apparently, he's never seen reality TV. He's never seen Honey Boo Boo if he thinks Community is the lowest form of television.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, he drinks. He's quite
Whoa.
The... Yeah, he. Well, I'm not saying anything that isn't publicly
here come
known.
The, here come the lawyers again.
Yeah. You know, he used to be quite the drinker, and at a Santa Monica bar, you could find him all the time at this one bar, and I can't remember the name of it, but he was always there. Always.
Well, but it doesn't mean he okay.
No, he was always there.
Okay.
In the always there kind of way.
Okay.
Well, now, speaking of news stories and people that we talked about when Karen was co-host of the show, Susan Boyle. Do you remember her? The frumpy middle-aged woman who blossomed into a pop star thanks to Britain's Got Talent. She is headed to the movies, and I don't mean she's going to go see a movie. I mean, well, anyway, for anyone
who probably went to see Exotic Marigold Hotel, though.
That's probably true, actually. You know, for anybody who listened to Showbiz Sandbox episode 31, by the way, you'd know that Boyle is one of the more unlikely stars in recent years. Boyle's fame was catapulted by a legendary audition singing. I Dreamed a Dream from Les Mis on the British talent show that became a YouTube sensation. And it made her a household name around the world, even though she didn't even win that competition during that season. Boyle has released a string of hit albums and seen her life story captured on stage in a new musical. Now her life story is headed to the movies via Fox Searchlight. This is my advice for Brenda Blethyn. Call your agent. Big deal or big whoop?
It's very much a big whoop. It would have been a big whoop even 3 years ago. But to do it now, it sounds like a Lifetime TV movie. I mean, anything can be a good film. She's had kind of a tabloidy existence in the UK, not from any particular shenanigans on her own, but she's was a little overwhelmed by the fame. So she had a collapse and this and that. And, you know, so there's interesting material there. Anything can be a good movie. I grant you that. But, I mean, this really is old news. My God, if you look at the sales of her albums, she's had four albums that have come out. Her first album sold 9 million copies worldwide. Her second sold 5 million copies worldwide. Her third sold 1 million copies worldwide. And her fourth has sold 100,000 copies worldwide.
Hold on, let me chart that for a second.
Yeah.
But wait
a
second.
Definition
that's
of
not
some
going...
of a flash in the pan whose time has passed. It doesn't mean you can't make a serious good movie out of it, but given the crappy stage play they made, I assume the film will be the same schlock and therefore not very interesting. This was a stage play called I Dreamed a Dream that toured the hinterlands. I don't even know if they took it to the West End, but, you know, schlock. So this is really way, you know, you're trying to cash in. You waited too long.
Wait, I've got a question. Are the hinterlands next to Scotland? Are they south?
They're in Manchester.
Ah, okay. Well, I put this next story in specifically for you, Michael, because, well, for two reasons, and you'll see why. Because one thing is really clear. Most artists do not like slot machines. And I thought the same thing when I saw this story. First, the gang from Happy Days sued over slot machines they discovered bearing their likeness. Now the estates of J.R.R. Tolkien, or Tolkien, or Tolkien?
Tolkien.
Tolkien. Well, they're suing Warner Brothers over all sorts of merchandising they say was never authorized, including, that's right, you got it, slot machines. The estate says they use the Lord of the Rings character for slot machines, online gambling games, and other variations. It's absolutely not authorized, and they want it to stop. And oh, by the way, toss in $80 million while you're at it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
What's a big deal? It seems like a constant battle to make sure they don't abuse the rights of what you give them to a studio. You know, you got to audit them. You got to keep looking at them. I mean, the idea that they would have slot machines with Lord of the Rings characters slapped on them and not even pay them, much less acknowledge that they've been doing it, is bizarre. I don't know how you're supposed to catch them doing that. I guess you just got to audit them. You know, you got to have that right and do it constantly. But and it's all sorts of things. It's not just video games and online gambling and slot machines. It's all sorts of other merchandise. And they said, we didn't authorize this.
Well, I wonder if, like, literally it's just because Warner Brothers is so big. And I'm not saying that people are, you know, irresponsible or don't know what they're doing. But where they literally read the contract and they read it in different ways. And one division says, yeah, we can do that. And another division doesn't even know about it.
That's awfully nice of you.
I'm not saying, as opposed to what, that they purposely went, hey, don't tell anybody, but we're going to have a whole bunch of slot machines.
Well, they made the deal in the 70s, you know, when these rights were sold, and it's a long, complicated history. And there was no anticipation of online gambling sites in the 1970s, but they said it was for the usual stuff at the time, T-shirts, calendars, mugs, that sort of thing. Now suddenly you got them on slot machines. They're like, well, we didn't approve. And their original contract specifically excluded anything not included in the original contract. They said, if it's not mentioned here, you don't have the right to do it.
Really? Because usually those contracts have the, and any, you know, any technology that is invented.
Well, no, that's for like the movie. That's like putting movies on new for, you know, this is merchandise. And I think it's a little different. But yeah, they claimed that they specifically excluded anything not mentioned in the original contracts. And the original contracts included stuff like they would anticipate in the 70s. And so they're like, it's not even a question, they say, that you don't have the right to this. So it's bizarre. I mean, people, if you're in Hollywood, go to Vegas, walk around the room, see if your name is on a slot machine. If so, sue. That's what I say.
And if you're not famous, ask yourself why your name is on that slot machine.
Yes, that's a good question.
Now, speaking of famous people, what do you think of this Peter Jackson and The Hobbit and all these, I guess there was some animal abuse allegations opposed about The Hobbit, shooting The Hobbit.
There's no question there was poor housing and treatment of animals that were used in the filming. The question is whether the people in the film were responsible for it and whether they acted appropriately when they found out about it. As a devout Lord of the Rings guy, to give them the benefit of the doubt, they say, since we heard about it, we called in the American Humane Association or whatever the international equivalent is. They went to the places where the animals were being housed and they did a full review, and the studio spent six figures updating the housing things to make sure the animals were treated properly. That's what they say happened. So as soon as we heard about it, we went to the people, we acted. The Humane Society says this is a long-term problem in the fact that we get to monitor animals on the set, but that's all we get to do. We have no power anywhere else. We can't go to see where the animals are kept at night. So we have no control over that whatsoever. We have no authorization unless they invite us in. We cannot demand to see where animals are kept, where they're housed, how they're treated offset. We were on the set of Lord of the Rings. All the animals were treated great while we were on the set. This stuff happened offset where they were housed. And yes, the studio did call us in at a certain point. We went in and found things that should be improved, and they did that. But we want the right to go to where animals are housed. If you're going to make a movie and use animals, we should have the right to go see where they're being stored and kept and treated.
Well, maybe if they weren't housing them in the Tower of Mordor.
Exactly. Peter Jackson, the studio, also say, hey, these wranglers didn't say anything for a year. And then they came out right when the movie's about to come out. And this is when they start telling publicly what was going on. Well, you know, that could be true, could be seen as just trying to get publicity. On the other hand, that's how you get publicity. You time it when it's going to be the most valuable to you. So that's how you get action taken or get people to do something about it. But they say when they heard about it, they did act. When it was brought to their attention, I don't know. You'd have to have a fuller investigation. But there's no question that, hey, you're going to have animals on sets and you want to say, hey, look, these animals are being treated fairly and kindly. You need to give the oversight people a chance to see where they're being housed. It just makes sense.
Did Jackson mention that all those animal wranglers are looking for book deals?
Book deals?
I'm kidding.
Oh, okay.
Well, let's move on to something that may be turned into a book one day, unfortunately. Sex scandals have even reached Sesame Street. We reported earlier on the news stories about Kevin Clash, the voice of Elmo, who has been accused of having sex with a minor. Since then, the now adult man who made the claim recanted. But then a day or two later, news stories reported he'd been paid six figures to do so, and he recanted his recant.
Well, I don't know. He didn't recant his recant.
Yeah, he did.
No, no.
He actually said, everything happened so fast, I didn't know. I was forced to by my lawyers. He actually did come out and say that.
Okay, you're sure?
Yes, positive.
Because he has to give back his six figures?
I don't know. But I remember thinking at the time, like, wow, this is such a mess. And then, immediately following all of this, another adult male claimed Clash had sex with him when he was a minor and filed a $5 million lawsuit against the performer. And I thought, uh-oh. Clash, of course, has now resigned from his job at Sesame Street for good. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal for him and Sesame Street. At the moment, it's a big whoop. It seems to have been, we'll have to see if it goes to trial, if the person gets paid off or the charges, or the civil suit gets dismissed or whatever. We'll have to see what happens with that. I mean, we're not at the end of the story. So there could be more publicity, more bad news for Kevin Clash come in the future. At the moment, what's always concerned me is how PBS dealt with it. Because it seems like from the news reports that they knew about it for 6 months and never approached the police. There's never been a mention anywhere of anyone like, yeah, we called the cops. This guy came up with this crazy charge. We didn't know what to think about it. They said they launched an investigation, decided Kevin wasn't guilty. And then the guy came forward and that's when it blew up in everybody's face. Well, what you should do is pick up the phone and call the police. And my concern for Sesame Street and PBS in general is that nobody on the right has made a big deal of this yet. You know, if you want to defund PBS, as they always want to, and Sesame Street is created by a company that's separate from PBS. So there are two different, entities. So we don't want to conflate the two, but certainly people will. And people will want to say, hey, why are we giving money to PBS to support pedophiles and make some ridiculous charge like that? But, you know, if they want to, they could launch a criminal investigation, a congressional investigation. When did PBS find out about it? What did they do about it? Did they change the procedures of Kevin Clash and how he was overseen? Did he do any public events? Were there children's tours at PBS? On, they could just make this a nightmare for PBS.
Are you running for Congress? Because you sound just like a U.S. congressman.
Right. They could make a nightmare for PBS and Sesame Street. Happily, they don't seem to have done that yet. I haven't heard any blowback from Rush Limbaugh or other stuff like that. I don't think they did the right thing. They should have picked up the phone and called the cops. But hopefully, this will not be a long-term problem. It could be. God knows what happened. Obviously, if anybody was, no one can consent to sex if they're a minor, if they're, depending on the age of consent. So if that happened, obviously you feel sorry for that person. The people coming out of the woodworks now, your thoughts are with them first. Kevin Clash's career is over, at least for a while. Perhaps he'll be able to come back in a few years and do something else, but his association with Elmo is probably gone forever. So it's just an ugly, sad situation that I don't think PBS dealt with properly, and therefore that could be a real big, bad problem for them down the road.
And as for the person making the second allegation, $5 million? Kevin Clash worked for, like, public television. He doesn't have $5 million.
Oh, yes, he... he's very wealthy from Elmo. Elmo
I'm
is massive.
Kidding.
And he doesn't work for public television. He works for the company that
Sesame
creates
Workshop.
Sesame Street.
Yeah, Sesame
very
Workshop.
Very separate, yeah.
You know, I wonder, and not to belabor this point, because we probably should move... We definitely should move on. But I wonder if in instances like this, because of the stigma that is associated with falsely accusing people of sexual molestation or sexual misconduct, that
the stigma of falsely accusing?
Well, okay. Well,
if someone gets accused, they're smeared, even if it proves later that they're innocent.
Exactly.
Yes.
Rather than going to the police, which can get out of hand very quickly, as we all know, and sometimes, it's not out of hand. There is a crime that has been committed, whether workplaces, be it PBS or otherwise. Don't call the police for that reason. They say, well, before
well, of
we
course
call
that's, the- of course they didn't, that's why they didn't call the police. They didn't want it to get out. That's exactly why they were wrong and they were stupid. They thought, we can't let this get out or it'll be bad PR. Well, guess what? Now you have worse PR because you didn't do anything about it. And for 6 months, who knows what else happened that you could be liable for down the road. But the point is, you're not a judge of whether a crime was committed. You're a business. You pick up the phone and you call the cops. You're trying to play the cutesy job of keeping a lid on it. And it's going to come back and blow up in your face. They thought they could keep it, make it go away. And instead, it's now an even worse scandal. It wouldn't be a scandal for PBS or Sesame Street if they picked up the phone and called the police and done the right thing from day one. Their ass would be covered. And now it's not. Now they're in trouble.
Or if they said, hey, this is not a workplace issue. Please take this to the police.
It doesn't matter. You don't decide whether or not to call the cops anymore. If someone says something's been done, they make a wild accusation, you're better off calling the cops. whether the person's mentally unstable or whether the charge is unfounded or whether it's a spurned lover or whether it's an actual instance of molestation or rape, that's not for you to decide. You better pick up the phone and call the cops and say, hey, this person just made this crazy wild accusation. We wanted to call you in. They can decide whether it's blackmail or a mentally unstable person or an actual charge of molestation. That's their job. But you do not want to say, oh, hey, don't bother us. And, you know, someone calls you up and says someone did this terrible thing. You hang up on them and go about your life? No.
Well, think about it this way.
You need to act now.
Movie that's coming out December 25th, which is very good, by the way. It's called West of Memphis. It's about the West Memphis Three.
Yeah.
With the Central Park Five, about the Central Park jogger.
That's two different movies.
Two different movies about people who, you know, the police basically ran roughshod over them, and they spent decades in jail because of it.
But, dude, that's nothing to do with this.
No, well, I understand that. But I guess what I'm saying is, I wonder if that...
There are crimes of injustice. That doesn't mean you can't... You get to avoid calling the police because sometimes they screw up. That's ridiculous. You're a business. Someone calls up and makes a crazy, wild charge. Cover your ass. Pick up the phone and call the police. You're the church. You're the Boy Scouts. You're Sesame Street. Doesn't matter. Not your job to investigate crimes and decide whether they're valid or not. You better cover your ass PR-wise, and you don't want it to get out. Guess what? It always comes out.
That's true.
Pick up the phone and call the police, or you're being stupid.
Well,
and
let me ask you this.
It doesn't come back to hurt them in the future.
Any workplace, so PBS or otherwise,
somebody
comes and says, hey, one of your employees sexually molested me, and the workplace says, well, did this happen at work? Did this happen because of work? And the answer is no to that. Should the employer, in this case, go to the police?
Absolutely. It's not your job to decide where. It's like, why are you calling us? Call the police. Hang up the phone. Call your lawyer. Have a meeting. Then pick up the phone and call the police. Tell your employee, we just got this crazy charge. We're calling the police. It's already out. Your hands are tied. You don't get to what they call, but say he murdered someone. You're like, well, what does that have to do with us? Call the cops, of course. But you don't hang up the phone and go about your job. Let's go have lunch now. Someone just accused them of murder.
Well, it didn't happen on company property, so
Yeah. It's like, we just got this crazy phone call. Doesn't mean, you know, of course you don't want it to go public. You say, we just got this crazy phone call from this person we never heard of accusing an employee of murder or rape or robbing a bank. We don't know what to make of it. We're calling you. Cops will look into it, decide whether the person's a nut or whether it's real or whatever. You know, that's their job. You don't get to decide. It's too bad they called you, but now, sorry, you're in it.
I'm calling everybody after this.
Absolutely. Yeah, you better call the cops.
I'm going to start accusing everybody, and more than likely, I'm going to be accusing, a couple of...
You'll go to jail.
Call
up a company and make a wild charge that's not true. Guess what? That's a crime. You're not allowed to call up companies and claim people raped you or robbed a bank or murdered someone. You can go to jail for that. You can certainly face a civil lawsuit. And you know what? If they'd gone to the cops right away, he might have been able to, turn that guy and say, you say one word to the media or anybody else and threaten my livelihood and threaten my life. And the person had, whatever justification they had for claiming it or not. If they're lying and you believe you have a case, you say, hey, you go to anybody, I'm suing you for $10 million. Guess what? Their lawyer who's working on pro bono to get a cut of whatever money they get, suddenly they're not going to be interested in going to trial to defend somebody who they don't think has a real case. And that person maybe doesn't go to the media, and then you don't have the second person coming out of the woodwork either trying to capitalize on it or whatever. Now, that's in the case where a person is innocent.
Well, Michael, my question is, you're trying to cover your ass. My question is, how do you really feel about this?
I think it's a good PR and good smarts to call. Somebody calls your company, makes a wild charge, which may happen once in your entire life. Pick up the phone and call the cops.
Well, then I am going to call my cable company to let them know they are robbing me blind.
You don't like sports?
Okay. Well, yes, that's what we're going to talk about next, because it is time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, I know, Michael, you are a huge Yankees fan.
I am.
And in fact, you have season tickets to help pay for, you know, the Yankees staff and the players, because that's really where they... Oh, wait, no, they don't make most of their money there. They make most of their money in broadcast rights. In fact, they have their own network, don't they? It's called the Yes Network.
That's right.
And that is called a regional sports network, an RSN. And they broadcast all the Yankee games. They also broadcast some New Jersey Nets games. Although, are they called New Jersey Nets or Brooklyn Nets now? Because they play in Brooklyn, but they're from New Jersey. I don't know. In any case, yes, as you said on a previous episode, a while back, you said, look, Yes is worth about $1 billion in and of itself. Forget the Yankees. Well, apparently they're worth over $3 billion because News Corporation, you know, News Corp, Rupert Murdoch, that guy, they are paying $1 billion, or at least they're buying 49% of the network.
They're buying 49% of the network, and they have the right within 3 to 5 years to buy up to 80% of the network. It believes that it's still going to be a non-controlling stake, that other people will still have control of the programming, even though they will have a majority of the network in 3 to 5 years, potentially. That's based on certain metrics. For the amount of money they're spending, they're valuing the network at over about $3 billion.
That's what I was trying to explain and doing a very poor job of.
So the network is now, based on how much they paid for their chunk, is worth about $3 billion. Of course, all that is tied up in Yankee rights. So when they made this deal, they got an agreement from the Yankees to lock them in for an extra 20 years beyond their current contract, which means the Yankees will have baseball on the YES Network through 2042. So that, it'd be, for various reasons, they already had contracts in place. That means that you're looking at 30 years from now before the rights come up again. There will still be some escalation in costs and stuff. It's not like they get it for the same low rate. But basically, they will have a lock on the Yankees for the next 30 years. You know what? That comes in the blink of an eye, though. So 30 years from now, the Yankees can make a ton of money going somewhere else. But anyway, the Yankees won't be able to yank their programming and start their own network like they did against MSG a few years ago. They were on the MSG network. They pulled away from them and started their own network, which is now worth as much, if not more, than MSG. So it's a wildly valuable property. Rupert Murdoch is taking over the YES Network. So people immediately said, oh my God, he's taking over the Yankees. Rupert Murdoch is buying the Yankees. Well, you know, they bought the Dodgers, News Corp did, a few years ago, and that was a disastrous deal.
A few years ago, it was over 10 years ago, and you want to talk about a disaster. I mean, ugh, what a pain in the... Anyway, I'm sorry.
Right, so that went very poorly. They were bad owners. They lost a lot of money. They were unhappy. They unloaded the team to, who is it?
What's his face?
Magic Johnson, or is it...
No, that's the new guys. Guggenheim partners with Magic Johnson and Peter Guber. They now own...
Right, they now own it.
Frank McCourt. And basically, Frank McCourt said, listen, you want to charge me $450 million to buy your team. Here's the thing. I don't have that. So can you loan me $250 million and I'll pay you, you know, 200 and some odd million dollars later? News Corp wanted to get rid of it so bad, get rid of the Dodgers so badly that they went, well, actually, yeah, we can do that. And so he bought the money, the team, with very little, if any, money, and then drove the team into the ground, into bankruptcy, literally into bankruptcy.
And cashed out a lot of money and sold it again.
Yes.
So anyway, baseball teams are a big pain to own. But because Rupert Murdoch is buying the YES Network, it doesn't mean he wants to buy the Yankees. Possible. The Yankees haven't said they want to sell, but they are cashing out on the YES Network. Why is Rupert Murdoch making this bid right now? Number one, they're on the hunt to spend money because they're worried about changes in the tax laws. They believe the second administration of Obama means there will be changes in the tax laws that make it ideal for them to invest in some businesses now. They're looking to buy Simon & Schuster, which is one of the biggest publishing houses in North America. It's one of the big six. Meanwhile, Random House is looking to merge with Penguin. So News Corp is looking to buy a big publishing company. They're looking to buy a big chunk of this TV network. They want to use some of the cash they have on hand before new tax laws go into place. Number two, they want to compete with ESPN. They see ESPN as a massive cash cow for ABC.
And News Corp, it is a cash cow for them.
It is. And News Corp around the world has built a lot of its business on sports rights. It launched its satellite division in the UK based on football rights, you know, European soccer. They've done that in Australia and Japan and China, all over the world. They've used sports to leverage their way into markets. They want to do that with the TV business. They have a number of regional networks now. They want to buy the YES Network and have another one. They ultimately want to compete with ESPN and have a massive national network that can vie for rights for major sports programming and be a big, you know, profit driver for the company.
Well, and they've been doing that since they bought the Dodgers. In fact, part of the reason Rupert Murdoch and News Corp sold the Dodgers was because Murdoch was on Charlie Rose, an interview show here on PBS, no less, here in the United States, and he explained why he bought the Dodgers. And he said, you know, Disney and ESPN, they were trying to create a second, you know, regional sports network, and they were going to buy, you know, they already owned the Angels, so they were going to try and get the Dodgers to do the same thing. And he thought, well, being locked out of the number two market in the country, that's not good. I'll buy the Dodgers, and therefore the Dodgers will be on Fox Sports West. And after he said that, and everybody realized why he bought the Dodgers and that he could care less about the team, there was such ill will that he was kind of forced to sell the Dodgers, and he did so unloaded them to Frank McCourt. Right now, Fox Sports Division owns 19 regional sports networks, all of which air, you know, the baseball teams in those networks.
Mm-hmm.
So, and remember, James Murdoch, the guy who's his son, embroiled in all this, you know,
disgraced
in the UK. I don't know if he's really disgraced. Please don't have your lawyers call us. Well, he was shipped off to the U.S. and he is now in charge of the company's, you know, the U.S. operations here. He's the chief operating officer. And so he's the one overseeing all of the television business and all the regional sports networks here in the U.S. And he was the one who helped kind of shuffle this deal through.
Hey, he's not going anywhere. He's still involved in the business, very much so. The one thing I question in the article we linked to, it's from the New York Times, is that they say at $3 billion, yes, would be worth more than the Yankees themselves. Ooh. I say, no, that's not possible.
Right. Well, because it's basically, how is the sum of it? Yeah, that makes no sense at all.
Controlling a piece of yes does not make you get control of the Yankees. They're completely separate businesses. My point is that yes is nothing without Yankee programming. And also, the Dodgers went for $2 billion. So when that happened, everybody said, well, I bet the Yankees would go for $3 billion, because if the Dodgers are worth $2 billion, the Yankees are sure as heck worth $3 billion. So yes Network has been valued equivalent to what the Yankees might be worth right now. But ultimately, I think the Yankees are worth more. You know, in 30 years, when that programming is up, guess what? The Yankees will be worth even more again. But I don't think it makes sense that to say that the TV subsidiary that depends on nothing but Yankees, you know, the YES Network does not have other sports programming of any note. So there's nothing on that channel except the Yankees. Yankees, Yankee reruns, Yankee biographies, the Michael Kay show. There is nothing on that channel if you don't have the Yankees. Zero, zip, zilch. So
wait,
you know,
is that less than one?
It is. It's okay. Not like ESPN where you got lots of different sports on there. They have one team and one team alone. So the Yankees are integral to that success of that network. Without them, they're nothing. Doesn't mean that somehow the TV rights couldn't be more valuable than the team itself. That could be true, but I don't think it's true given what the Dodgers were paid for.
Well,
and they
now
say,
speaking
well,
the of
the Dodgers,
Dodgers
got a lot of money because of their TV rights. I'm like, well, yeah, but it doesn't make any sense.
Well, now speaking of the Dodgers, right after I put this in our show notes last night, there I was watching the evening news, and sure enough, right now Fox is in an exclusive negotiating period with the Dodgers, and it looks like they're going to settle on, I think it's $7 billion for a 25-year broadcast rights to Dodger games. $7 billion. So I guess the $2.15 billion was actually not so bad.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's $280 million a year, which covers their entire payroll before they even sell a single ticket.
Covers a lot more than their payroll.
Right. They better win the World Series every single year for that type of money.
You can't buy the World Series.
Apparently not. But, you know, what John Malone, who is he's a cable pioneer. He's in charge of Liberty Media. He's the chairman. He says, look, all this sports stuff, and this is a quote. He says, we've got runaway sports rights, runaway sports salaries, and what is essentially a high tax on a lot of households that don't have a lot of interest in sports. The consumer is really getting squeezed, as is the cable operator. And he's saying, enough. We can't.
Well, then don't pay for it.
And he's not. And that's, I guess, why he's a little upset, because he can't afford it. And he could afford it, actually, if he really wanted to. He could. He doesn't want to participate in it.
Liberty has no sports programming?
Well, they do, so that's why I kind of took that back. I was trying to recant, but I wasn't going to recant on my recant. In any case.
Yeah, sports programming gets a lot of money because it's valuable. I agree that they're in a crazy period of huge profits and, you know, massively increasing the price networks pay to get sports programming, even as their ratings dwindle. It's sort of a crazy little period here. But hey, if you think it's too much money, don't buy it. See how well your channel does without sports.
Well, no, see how much your cable offerings do without sports. Because right now, if you wanted to watch the Discovery Network and National Geographic and Animal Planet and the Food Network, you have to pay $5 per month for ESPN. Even if you didn't want it, you'd have to pay.
Well, no. You get hundreds of channels when you buy cable programming.
That is right.
It's a bundling together of a bunch of channels. The ones that are the most expensive are sports, specifically ESPN. But you do get hundreds of channels, and you get to watch whatever you want. So the idea that you have to pay $5 for someone else to watch sports, guess what? You know, if he's going to argue for a la carte, argue for a la carte. Cable companies have fought that tooth and nail for decades. So if he wants to argue for a la carte, go right ahead.
Well, and he has actually, that's exactly what he's doing. That's exactly what this article in the LA Times is pointing out is. This is the guy that has
fought. Oh, really?
Yeah, this is a guy. He has really well known for trying to resist any kind of government intervention. And he's saying now, this is a quote, the only way it is going to change in the short run is for government to intervene. That is a quote from him. He's saying, look, it's so out of control that even I can't stop it anymore.
Well, it would have stopped long ago if he hadn't fought a la carte.
Right.
Right. But you know what? A lot of people would pay the $5 for ESPN.
That's right.
So he's changing his tune.
That's true.
So Malone, for years fighting against government intervention, now begs the government to intervene so they can stop him from forcing himself to pay a lot of money for sports.
I have no idea what you just said at all. I think that what you just said was circular and makes no sense. But, you know, normally we make a lot of sense. And speaking of begging, we beg you to subscribe to our podcast, Showbiz Sandbox, and iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away for free. We also beg you to rate and review the show on any podcast aggregator. iTunes, again, is a good place to go. Stitcher
can
as well.
Can't we just ask them to? Do we have to beg?
Okay, fine. We ask you politely. Also, we ask you to follow us on Twitter, where our username is Showbiz Sandbox. And you could like us on Facebook, where our username is, get this, Showbiz Sandbox. You know, links to follow us and to subscribe, they can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all the stories we talked about in today's episode, as well as ways to contact us. You can send us your thoughts and your feedback on the show. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is toll-free, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael, who is located in New York, but can often be found on the Huffington Post or his own website, which is
michaelgiltz.com.
Very hard to remember. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.